episode 9 of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobia. With me tonight is co-founder Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hey, guys.
And also on the crew tonight is Lester Crow and his strolling bows.
Hola.
Dan, soon to have a new handle, Carrick, is not with us tonight. He had to go do something silly like study for finals and actually graduate from college and have a life and a career. So we know where his priorities lie, but hopefully he does well and will be back with us next episode or soon.
If I understand correctly, he's actually done and really just needs to coach through the graduation process.
Blasphemous traitor.
No, what I heard is that he's actually got a final tomorrow from the recording. So tonight is that last minute cram session.
Is that
Oh my god.
Is that her name?
Ha 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 ha. And all right, there we go. 5 minutes, even less than 5 minutes into it, and we've already gone blue. So today we've got a great episode here, folks. We've got some cool and unique stuff. Really, all that we're going to be talking about, or mostly all that we're going to be talking about today, is Omens of War. So Omens of War came out a couple weeks ago. Two out of the three of us have had a handle on it, so we've read through it, and we're going to talk about it for the majority of the episode. But also in the middle here, we've got a special treat. We've actually got one of the contributors to Omens of War, Ian Robinson, who's one of the freelance writers for FFG. And Jesse, you and Lester, actually, because he is actually from the UK, so you will hear a real British accent on our podcast, not just us trying to fake it.
Yeah, and he does a lot better job at it than Dan does.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. But of course, being in London and the time differences, we couldn't get him on at our regular time that we record. So that'll be put in the middle of it. But really, we're going to hopefully we'll start off with some news and we'll wrap things up with the question and answer. So we'll just get things kicked off because we've got a lot to talk about today. So Jesse, we've got a Kublai Khan coming up, and you're kind of carrying the Reckless Dice flag to that.
I am, and I got my brand new shirts to prove it. Yeah, Kublai Khan, I know we've been pimping it for a few episodes now, and I'll probably continue to do so as we get closer to it actually arriving, which is the last weekend of May, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. It's a big gaming convention in southern San Francisco. All kinds of gaming, huge role playing, huge tabletop war games, card games, everything. Anyway, I'm looking to get some of the community members together, play some games while we're there. We already have about 10 people from the forums and other areas who are going to be meeting up and playing some Warhammer while we're there. So I'd love to have some more. If you guys are interested, hit me up on Twitter at jburkedesign. We're going to be using the hashtag KublaiCon and also the hashtag WFRP. So if you guys don't use Twitter, though, just shoot me an email at jburke.design@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to make sure that you guys are part of our fun. And cool. So taking a, you know, we'll set KublaiCon aside. We've had a lot of fun coming up with a new handle for Dan, and he chose to be all educated this session. So, you know, he's absent for this recording. So what we're going to do is postpone announcing what Dan's new handle is going to be and give us one more week to kind of, drum up a few more. We have a pretty healthy roster brewing. We've got about 10 or 15, ranging from the absurd to the hysterical to the dirty to the embarrassing. So what I think we'll do is, I think we'll maybe even try and throw those up onto a poll on our Facebook page and see if we can have some people judge which one's the most popular. Because Dan did say he would abide by whatever one we chose.
I already know what one I like.
I have a couple that I like too, but I don't want to say them yet. I don't want to influence anybody. But we'll go through some of the best ones next episode.
See, that's the difference between Dan and I. The only tests I take are initiative tests.
Oh, good segue. Way to bring it back into role playing there.
Oh man. So, the last bit of news that I have for everyone is I'd mentioned last episode that I'd be doing a Map Tools introduction session over last weekend, and we were going to record that that session and post it up on the site so everybody could view kind of how to use Map Tools, what's it all about. We did the session, we had a good turnout, and we had had some fun discussing, you know, some introducing people to the tools, answering questions. All in all, it was really nice. Except I mucked up the recording and the screen capture didn't work properly, so it'll be our first lost episode. I'm sorry.
I think that's probably our second or third lost episode, actually, if we're counting. But
do we have other lost ones?
I think so, but you know, that'll all come out in the collector's edition.
That's right.
When we put the season
when together. We remaster it.
Yeah, exactly.
So
get it in HD.
That's right, in 3D too. So I will probably run another one of those sessions because I know there was loads of people who wanted to participate that couldn't because of time conflicts or whatever. So I do want to do it again, and I'll make sure we advertise it in plenty of time ahead of time, and I promise not to screw up the recording this next time.
Good. I want to be a part of that, so.
I heard good stuff from it. It seems like people were pretty happy with it. So
yeah, we had people all over the world joining in on it too, which is cool.
Cool. All right. Well, we're going to keep things moving, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll start a discussion about Omens of War. And we're back. So here in the first segment, we're going to split up the segments on Omens of War. And in this first segment, we're going to talk a little bit more about the mechanics. So we're not going to do a system spotlight that we usually do at this point. We're going to talk about specifically the systems and the mechanics that are introduced in Omens of War. Then we're going to have our interview with Ian. And then in the second part of our Omens of War after the interview, we'll get more into kind of the background stuff and the things about Khorne specifically. So kicking things off, the first thing that I want to talk about is, in general, I know that I was on record at a previous episode that I was a little concerned that by adding these mechanics to the system, that they were potentially gilding the lily, that they were kind of bolting things onto the side. And I have to say, after seeing it all here and looking through it all, I'm very impressed. It fits right into what they've already created. Severe injuries are not and they are a special type of critical wound, but they are just regular wound cards, and they're treated like wound cards.
Somebody called that.
the enhancements.
Lester. I don't remember Lester.
I don't know either. I don't know the guy. He must be a jerk.
Must be from Canada.
The enhancements are actually just regular actions. They're actions that are added on to other actions, but from a how do you get them, how do you use them, what are the specifics about them, you know, what do you spend advancements to get them and all that kind of stuff, or how are they treated within the game? They're treated just like regular actions as well.
Yeah,
so,
awesome.
Even with the horses, you know, there's already precedence with that, with the small but vicious dog with the rat catcher. So it is just another animal companion that's done. Mounted combat's just a couple of simple rules that they have there. So really, I'm very pleased that they've kind of folded it into the existing structure of the mechanics that they have, and they haven't gone on and, you know, glommed on the, you know, stuck it on there with Bondo. So
is anybody else feeling that the action cards are a little out of control, like quantity?
No, I love it. Love it. The more the better.
I think maybe it's just because I GM more than I play, and maybe the action cards would be more appealing if I was a player, but the I find that it's just this giant stack that I just don't really read. I put them nicely into my folder. They look pretty. I look at a few of them and then say, maybe I'll read these some other time. And that's just this pile that keeps growing that I never really look at. And everything else I find extremely interesting, but this spells, love them, but melee ranged, all these action cards, just, I don't have this desire to use them.
Well, and they're not necessarily, I mean, so, you know, from the other side of the world, right, the action cards from the GM side, right, you've got your action cards now with the creature vault. You've got the creature action cards, you know, that you're using for that. So that's really your wheelhouse when you're the GM. The player, you know, has all those options in front of them. I think it's great. I think it was a really smart move by Fantasy Flight because, you know, they don't necessarily, unless they're going to go back and do, kind of update the core books that they had, the guides that they put out, you know, there isn't what it's up to Player's Guide 3 or 4 in Dungeons and Dragons 4th edition now, because as they add on those new abilities and things like that, you know, they've got to print another book for it. Whereas Fantasy Flight, you know, it's just your deck of cards gets bigger.
Yeah, so I agree.
You mentioned the monster cards, and I just wanted to do a quick plug. I think it was on the forums I saw this. Someone had put together a really nice PDF of all the creatures from the bestiary and all the adventures to date and all of these suggested action cards that creature should have access to.
Yeah, that's
and
sweet.
We should, I'll see if I can find that for the show notes, but that thing was a great resource where if you just pull the boar or whatever, it went a little bit above and beyond what the bestiary tells you to use, and kind of also adds in a few that are just appropriate for that creature type.
Yeah, to try to allay your disdain for all the action cards too, Jesse, you got to remember, as a game master, you can use the player action cards for your creatures as well. Like, especially, I like to run, when I'm GM, I like to have most of the bad guys actually be human as opposed to monsters. So you have the option of using all of those cards.
I think I've just kind of refrained from using action cards in general, even as a GM. I think wrongly so, but that's something I'm hoping to break in the near future, because it's just been one extra layer of complexity that kind of, in my mind, held things up a bit. Even though they were cool, I'd like to incorporate those more.
Yeah, learn to love the cards, man. And speaking of which, let's talk about them. So, let's dig into the severe injuries first. So there was a lot of talk about that, and you got the preview online. Really what the severe injuries are is that there's 15 cards. They are the same size and have the same backing as regular wound cards. So you actually shuffle them into your wound deck, and then when the normal wound gets flipped over to be the critical wound, oops, surprise, it's a severe injury instead of a critical wound. So they aren't activated any differently than a critical wound. They're just a kind of a critical wound plus. And really what the severe injuries have, the differentiation between the severe injuries and the critical wounds, is that they have two different effects on an individual. The first effect takes effect immediately. So if we take a look at something like I've got here, severed finger. So you smash a finger on your sword hand, you suffer a misfortune die to all actions where that finger is the use of that finger is important. That's just a regular critical wound. Nothing actually, nothing different occurs there. But then along the middle of the card, there's a number, which is the severe injury threshold. If the severity of your critical wounds goes above that threshold, so for this severed finger, it's a 9, if the number of your severe wounds, if the severity of your critical wounds goes above that number, then you do the effect that's below the line, which in this case is you lose the finger, this wound is permanent.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's really a lot of what the severe injuries are, is that if you go over that critical threshold, the wound becomes permanent is usually the result of it. So
there's even one in there that just straight up kills you.
That's the headshot. So the headshot is, when it's a regular critical wound, you suffer misfortune die to all intelligence checks. And then if the sum total of your critical wounds is higher than 13, you're dead. Flat out dead.
So 13, so that means you'd need to suffer, how bad do your critical wounds need to be to trigger that?
Well, the severe injury itself counts. So a headshot starts you out with 4.
Okay, so that means then, so let's say if the average character is slain when he gets, once you have more criticals than your wound threshold? I mean, then your toughness?
and your wound threshold is below zero.
Okay, yeah. So let's say that a toughness of 3 for the average character. So let's mm-hmm. say all 3 of those criticals were at value 4, mm-hmm. which is unlikely because the average critical value of a critical wound is or severity rating is 2.
It's 2 or 3.
Yeah.
So the likelihood of actually triggering that, the character is going to die most likely before that effect ever sees the light of day, unless you're a dwarf.
Again, Jesse, let me be very, very clear. You can take as many critical wounds as you want, as long as your total wound threshold is above 0.
Yep, I keep missing that point. You're right.
Yep.
So if you have a whole bunch of critical wounds,
you're right. There it is. Thank you.
If you have a ton of critical wounds, and then you take that card, you draw a headshot, you're dead.
Absolutely.
If you have 9 severity of critical wounds, and that could only be 3. You could have 3 critical wounds and then pull headshot, and your character's dead.
Mm-hmm. I see where that's going to be a lot more effective now.
Oh yeah.
So one of the interesting things that they have here, and I'm not going to go into the details of it, but they actually have rules for prosthetics in here.
What if you lose
a leg, or if you lose a hand, or things like that, and they even have some magic items that are related to that, which is kind of cool.
That hand pistol flintlock thing.
Right. There's a finger gun, and then there's this magical golden hand and that sort of stuff. So that's kind of cool. They even talk about it specifically is that, you know, make sure you're okay with your players, because if you lose a leg, that character may be just as good as dead. Your player may not even want to play that character anymore. But here's some things that you might want to do, or maybe retire or something like that. But here's some things that you can do so that, you know, the person isn't completely left behind in the party. So it definitely raises the stakes. But again, depending on how you put together your wound deck, it's only 15 cards. And talk about a stack of cards. There's a ton of wound cards out there. So.
Yeah, there's got to be over 100 now.
Oh, there are. Yeah, there's 120-something, I think.
So what I want to talk about next is the actions that are included, and there's a ton of them. We've got 21 new melee actions, about half a dozen ranged actions, and about 10 or 11 support actions, not just counting the new enhanced actions, but what the focus is that you get out of Omens of War is that it's really focusing on fighting styles. And again, as I mentioned before, fighting styles, you're already familiar with it, right? The actions that have Slayer on it as a trait, or Judgment, those are actually have been previews of fighting styles.
Mm-hmm.
So they've added a whole bunch more. So there's the Zweihander, which is the idea that you've got a great weapon, a two-handed weapon. Bulwark is your traditional one sword, one shield. Hunter's Eye is ranged, focusing on archery. Diestro is the fencing. Twin weapon, so a sword in each hand. Thunder is with gunpowder. Then there's Mounted, which is from horseback. And then the Judgment and the Slayer, which we're familiar with and already have action cards for, those are called out as specific styles as well. So these are styles that aren't necessarily tied. Judgment and Slayer kind of are, but the other fighting styles aren't necessarily tied to a particular career. So
if someone wanted to begin using a style, all you have to do is acquire the action card for it, or are there some other prerequisites to gain access or open up that style?
No, and across the board, again, if you're taking the rules as written, Fantasy Flight has said that, you know, the traits are not restrictions unless you as the GM specifically want it. So a human could pick up a Slayer action if they wanted to. Now, for myself personally, I like to keep things a little more unique to the careers and the abilities that you've got. So things like, you know, Way of the Sword is for sword masters. The War Dancing is for the war dancers. You know, the Ancestor is for the dwarves. Judgment is for witch hunters, and Slayer is for dwarven slayers. But specifically things like Zweihander, Bulwark, Thunder, Diestro, Twin Weapon, those are open to anybody, any career.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because it's just a fighting style, right? It's something your character has practiced.
So does it make sense to be able to mix and match and like grab some from multiple styles? Does that just kind of show that you're a well-versed in different fighting styles, or is that kind of start clashing with the concept?
Well, now the requirements of the action are related to the fighting style. So if you've got a Bulwark action card, then it's going to specifically say in the requirements, melee weapon and shield equipped.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a great weapon, you can't use that action because you've got a great weapon or a two-handed weapon, not a sword and shield.
Got it.
So mixing and matching the styles is good if you've got a backpack full of weapons and gear.
Yeah, if you're carrying a great axe on your shoulders and a sword and shield equipped, then, you know, you drop your sword and shield, pull out the great axe if you want.
Now, what if I have a prosthetic two-handed sword on my left arm, a buckler, and then my rapier in my right arm? Can I use both the Diestros, Vihander, and Bulwark all at once?
Shut up, Jesse.
Then, I think if that occurs, Jesse, then your GM sucks. I think that's what that says right there. So let me talk about the enhanced cards. The enhanced cards are actually, there's six cards that are here, and they're associated with each of the fighting styles. So there's a Zweihander's enhanced card, which is the half-haft grip. There's a Bulwark, which is testing metal. The Duelist Finesse is the Diestro card. So what these are is that in all aspects of the game, they're treated as actions. So you spend an advancement to buy, to acquire it. It has a recharge on it. It has requirements for it. It has a reckless side and a conservative side. But what happens is that after you declare an action and a target, you also declare an enhancement. And the enhancement has three lines. And each of the lines is represented by one of your positive dice in your pool. So there's a fortune line, there's a characteristic die line, and then there's an expertise die line. And you can cash in a maximum of one of each of those types of dice to get the benefit that's on the card if the action is successful. So you're risking that I don't need these many dice to be successful, but if I am successful, I'm going to get a bonus.
Yeah, it's like gambling.
It's interesting that they brought this mechanic in because I think it addresses a couple things that people have been complaining about, which was the it's too easy to succeed at actions. And this, in essence, makes it harder to succeed, but cashes it in for a little greater effect. And I think that those players who are hitting too often, or where they have an 85 or 90% chance of success on every attack they do, this is a chance for them maybe to fail a little bit more, but make their attacks more powerful. And I think that it you're able to keep still an appropriate threshold of success.
And there's this, what you said, Lester, about gambling, that's absolutely the case, because it's increasing levels, right? So yeah. A fortune die is going to give you less benefit than a characteristic die, which gives you less benefit than an expertise die. And they actually take that into effect because the majority of the cards on both the conservative and reckless side have kind of a fourth enhancement that says if you spend an expertise die and you've already spent a characteristic die and a fortune die, then here's a fourth thing that occurs. So for example, the Zweihander that I've got here, if you spend a fortune die, you gain +1 damage. Right. If you spend a characteristic die, you gain +1 damage. So if you do a fortune die and a characteristic die, you get +2 damage. If you spend an expertise die, attack gains +1 damage. So that's +3. And you also get +1 critical if you've spent both a fortune and a characteristic die. So if you spend a fortune, characteristic, and expertise die by using this enhancement, you gain +3 damage, +1 critical to your attack.
That's crazy. So, Paul, I have a really quick question. With the mechanics as you see them right now, do you think that they're going to start enhancing other things like social actions?
That would be kind of cool. And in fact, I'd really like to see that. I mean, so we got the magic, we got the faith, and I know we've talked about this before. What I'm really hoping is that the next one that's coming out, the Slaanesh one, the halfling one, you know, whatever the rumors are about. I really hope they focus on the social and non-combat aspects and would have kind of enhancements for support actions or social actions.
I think the consensus on the forums for the Slaanesh expansion is the nobles and kind of the nobles and merchant classes.
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
So more social oriented for sure.
Yeah, I think the hopes and dreams of halflings appearing in that expansion are pretty much zero now.
Yeah, you never know. So one of the other things that they have in here, of course, is the rules for being mounted. So particular careers actually get horses as animal companions, just like how the rat catcher got a small but vicious dog. So you get special, specialized horses. But in terms of generalization of, having a horse, maintaining a horse, there's really one stat that you need to track. Two stats, actually. The strength of the horse and then their wind. So wind kind of takes into account, it's almost like the horse is a minion.
Mm-hmm.
Or a henchman. So if they take fatigue, it affects their wind. If they take damage, it affects their wind. Although if any damage is caused to the horse, it just takes one wind. You don't calculate actual total damage. So if somebody hits your horse, the horse takes one wind. Once your horse gets down to zero wind, then it's a special status that they call that your horse is blown. I'm not a horseman. I don't understand where that comes from, but I'm sure it means something to people who actually ride horses.
I don't think it's a good idea to blow your horse.
So once the horse is blown, then you are basically making tests against your ride and animal handling to keep your horse alive if it takes additional fatigue or damage or things like that. And then the horse is basically gone at that point. So, you know, there's different, there's different modifications to the horse. So there's the draft horse is just straight up strength 6 with no special rules, but a riding horse has less strength 5, but is swift, which is what we talked about when we talked about the creature's guide and some earlier episodes where swift creatures can move twice. Basically, they get an extra maneuver to move.
So a blown horse is synonymous with like a fatigued horse.
Yeah, or damaged, or you know, because you can take wounds as well. So there's different types of horses, and that kind of fits into the careers, which is the last thing that I want to talk about in terms of the mechanics. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 new careers, and they are all very martially focused.
So I love the new careers. I thought they were great.
And they're all, except for one, they're all advanced. There's only one basic career in the whole pack, and that's the Pistolier.
And we should point out that that one of the careers that is labeled as a basic career is meant to be an advanced career, and I think even a second or third tier career.
Yeah, that's the Preceptor career. So there's actually, similar to the way that, priests and wizards have their kind of progression. Knights are given the same thing here. So they're supposed to start out as outriders, which is actually an advanced career in and of itself. But then there is the knight career that's above that. And then there's the Knight of the Inner Circle that's above that. And it's a specific requirement. You have to complete the knight career before you can become a Knight of the Inner Circle. And then once you complete the Knight of the Inner Circle, then you become a Preceptor. And that's the one that's mislabeled as a basic career because it is at least a rank 3, if not a rank 4.
Well, let's say that would make it you come from a basic to an outrider to a Knight of the Inner Circle to a Preceptor would actually put it at a tier 5. Career, which might even be our first tier 5.
Knight is just a regular advanced career, so you can go straight into knight. There's no.
I thought you said that outrider fed into knight.
In the fluff.
Okay, I'm with you.
That is where it comes from.
Okay, so technically it falls into tier 4. Though story wise, it could in theory be a 4 or a 5.
Right, exactly.
But that would probably even still put it at the most advanced career available to date, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It's kind of almost battle wizard level, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So how do you fix that if it's mislabeled? What do you guys do?
I got a little magic marker. Nice. Scratch it out and write advanced on it. It's my card.
I didn't do anything to it. I just put it into my advanced careers folder pages.
Okay.
Somebody on the forums mentioned it, so I wouldn't have known, even though it doesn't look like a basic career at all. But the other neat thing that the knight careers offer is similar to mages and priests is they offer, I think are they called order cards?
Mm-hmm.
The order cards where you can be essentially, different flavors of knights. Oath, thank you, because the knights would have taken oath. So you can be like knights panther, you can be, knights of Auric and all sorts of cool things from all the different regions of the empire. You can be region specific. I wasn't expecting that when I opened up the box and went through it. I was certainly expecting the careers, but not those careers to be broken down on that level. And I'm really happy they did that.
Yeah, there's six knightly orders that are included, with Omens of War. So Reichsguard, Knights Panther, Knights Griffin, Order of the Fiery Heart, Knights of the White Wolf, and Knights of the Blazing Sun.
Awesome. All the ones I remember from the tabletop games.
Yeah.
And just like with the wizard and priest careers where your order or faith are slotted as talents along the side, that's the same thing for knights and their oaths.
Okay.
And I think is it important to mention that the knights in the empire are not knights like you might think of from like King Arthur's court where you have a squire and you're noble and all this kind of stuff like that. Most knights in the empire are just dudes who have some money and have armor. It doesn't really follow that kind of traditional European medieval.
Well, that's Bretonnia, right? The Bretonnian knights are more right. Like the traditional knights.
Yes. So the knights of the empire are much more, financially well off or have the equipment and are capable. They don't necessarily, they're not all like dukes and they don't all own land and have squires and whatnot.
They're more like the merchant classes that went to war during the, like, back in the Crusades and stuff like that. There were a bunch of really wealthy people who just went to war for glory and for things along those lines.
Right.
Well, a lot of the text actually talks about, a lot of the fluff text actually talks about the nobility of the knights. If you take a look at it, the Outrider class, the Outrider career, does not have noble as one of its traits, but the knight career does. So, if you're getting into a knight career from your existing career, it's easier to do it if your career has the noble trait.
Well, I think that certainly makes sense. I mean, if the nobles have money and therefore can afford things like horse, fancy armor, and everything that would be required to send somebody of that caliber off to war.
And prestige too, right? Like a noble's going to be able to move through the social network a lot easier than somebody who's not noble.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, that's actually the Pistoliers are also a noble class as well. They're basic military noble specialists. So.
Yeah, they're like the son. They're like the second sons because the first sons get all the land and the second sons go off to war or go be priests or whatever.
So the Pistoliers, so the Outriders are actually the veteran Pistoliers that haven't become knights. Along those lines, there are veteran soldier careers as well. So you've got the sergeant, the veteran, and the captain for those as well. So you have the capability to advance your soldier along whether or not you want to be commanding, which is where you go into sergeant and captain, or you're just a better soldier, which is what the veteran is.
So that's another tier four character, right? Or are those two tier threes?
The captain does not have a particular requirement. So you can go straight from, captain is an advanced career. So you can go straight from, soldier to captain if you want to, if you're willing to spend it. So only the knights have a specific that,
the only reason I bring it up again and again is I know a lot of folks are interested in, where are our tier three characters? Where are our tier four careers? Where's our advanced, where's our high level content? And I just wanted to make sure to point it out when it's available. Because some of it, just given the way that they format the game, doesn't really say I'm the advanced career, because all the advanced careers visually look the same. There's nothing to distinguish one advanced career from the other unless you read the fluff text and the prerequisites to determine what comes before or after it, if anything.
Yep. So that kind of wraps up what you get mechanically for Moments of War. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, this is going to be the interview. Again, we pre-recorded it, so you're going to hear Jesse and Lester talking to Ian Robinson about digging a little bit more into Omens of War and kind of his experiences contributing to it and that kind of stuff. So we'll be right back.
Yeah, please enjoy. All right, so we're back, and we have a special treat for this episode. We have Ian Robinson, a contributor to Omens of War, with us to talk a little bit about the product and the freelance aspects of working with Fantasy Flight. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Cool. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, for my sins, I'm a consultant during the day, but I like to, when I can, get my hands on as much writing as possible. I think ideally I'd like to do more and more kind of as time goes on. So I've been lucky enough to contribute to Fantasy Flight, and then I also do a bit of writing for a games website called playdevil.com, mainly reviewing Xbox 360 titles, but the odd PlayStation and Wii game here and there as well.
I'm also
quite a big fan of Warhammer Fantasy Battles, and you can, if you're in the UK, see me in a campaign that's going on at the minute, doing a bit of Beastman action.
Nice.
That's sweet.
Always been a fan of the tabletop game. That's where I started. You did do some contributions to the Omens of War product that was just released last week.
I did indeed.
And can you give us a little bit of a outline on what you did do to it?
So the vast majority of what I was doing was all of the background information on Khorne. So at the start of Liber Carnegie, all the background stuff there. I've also contributed towards some of the historical battle sections as well.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So what is it? So in a nutshell, I'd like to hear. And obviously, you're very familiar with the Omens of War product at this point. So what is, in your words, what is Omens of War? Why is this a cool product?
I was super excited to be asked to help out with Omens of War, really. I was given a choice at the time. I think, you know, firstly, you've got the whole aspect of Khorne. He's, I guess, perhaps the most easy of the Chaos Powers to relate to, in the fact that he goes around and he likes to smash stuff up. You know, he's like the ultimate badass in the Warhammer world, and just, you know, has that influence on people, all the marauders that come down and create huge problems for people in the old world. And again, also, it was an opportunity to get really involved in some of the combat stuff, and all the historical battle stuff is some really interesting fluff on there about how kind of war is waged in the old world and the Reichland.
So tell us specifically, what were one of the did you work on the battle section, the historical battle section? Did you specifically write some of the content? Did you how do you during the process really get involved with do you do research on from other, you know, canon content and kind of pull it together? Do you write unique content for it? Where does that balance get struck?
There's a real mix. You know, officially this stuff is technically not regarded as canon. Basically any stuff that gets published by GW is, and that doesn't include any of the Black Library novels either. Obviously, you can go to them for inspiration, and there's so much stuff out there. It's one of the best things about role-playing in the Warhammer world, in my opinion, that we've just got this huge treasure trove of information that's been created over the last 20 or 30 years that you can dip in and out of. So I'm lucky enough to have a pretty huge collection, which I'm looking at. I've got kind of all of the second edition stuff and quite a lot of the various Black Library special edition kind of books that have come out over the years. So there's nothing wrong with adding new elements to the system. I know one of my battles was totally created by me, but another one took a lot of inspiration from one of the background books that does focus on basically puts you in the shoes of being a young imperial kind of general or wannabe general, and shows you what kind of tactics the empire use. And it's a fascinating book as an empire player in the past myself as well, kind of looking into it. And you know, you can use it for fluff and for tactics for the tabletop game.
That's really interesting. What was the particular battle that you had written that you just referenced, the one that you kind of that you came up with? I'd like to go back and, you know, reread that one now, knowing who made it.
Great. Okay.
And completely criticize it on the show next episode too. Just kidding.
He'll do it too. No, just jokes. I'm kidding.
So the one I wrote myself it involves a rash Bretonian noble and Kurt Hellborg coming to the rescue, and sneakily in there, kind of putting in one of the characters that plays in our weekly game as well.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I was going to ask you, where can we find the Easter eggs that you left in the book?
Well, I'm hoping that Otto the Magnificent becomes a well-featured character within the Warhammer world within a few months or years, if I have my way.
Is that like Lester? That's kind of like where I added Burksburg for my last name. I created a city for myself on my Warhammer map, and I'm planning on anybody who references this map going forward that'll become a prominent city in the north of the Border Princes.
Yeah, pretty sweet.
Yeah, why not? Well, the Border Princes is there to be manipulated anyway.
Right, exactly. That was everybody's feedback too. I'm like, well, if I were to make a town, where should it live? And it's like, there's no reason why I wouldn't live in the Border Princes.
Yeah, that's pretty much why it was created.
Mm-hmm. So, Lester, what are your thoughts on Omens of War? I know you've been pretty excited about it.
Well, I haven't yet got my hands on it because here in Canada, I don't think it's been released. I think it comes to the shops next weekend. So I haven't seen it yet, but I'm super excited for it. It's Khorne's pretty good. I prefer Nurgle, but with Omens, I'm just really excited for the combat, the new options, and I really like the flavor text books. Because like you, Ian, I have quite a bit of the second edition stuff, and I've been like steeped in the mythos of Warhammer for years and years and years. So I really like those books. The Liber. What's the one in Omens of Warhammer?
Carnegie.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to reading that.
So Ian, what is you touched on this whole episode is pretty much focused on Khorne and Omens. So, you know, in a nutshell, in your words, who is Khorne and why should we care?
Okay, so Khorne is obviously the blood god, and you need to care about him if you ever go into combat. He is typically regarded as the least subtle of the Chaos powers, but at the same time, if you go into battle and you start slaying people, cleaving people in twain, left, right, and center, then he's the kind of person that will start to creep into your brain, into your mindset, and be like, hey, this killing stuff, it's pretty cool. Why don't you do a bit more of it? And you can easily be dragged into this kind of vicious circle where you almost become addicted to death, and you can start to worship him almost without really knowing it.
Said, do you think that the witch hunters are quite susceptible to his influence? Do you think there's many that have fallen away?
The witch hunters are brilliant. We've got a witch hunter in our game that we play in, and he is always on the brink of falling into the grasp of one of the Chaos powers or the other. And yeah, absolutely, they are just as susceptible as anyone else.
Yeah, I just think with their extreme violent nature, well, not all of them, but for the most part, I think that Khorne would really be the one who just grabbed them by the throat, you know, twist their mind.
That's one of the brilliant parts about the Witch Hunter concept as a whole, is that in order to fight the Chaos, and you have to understand it. In order to understand it, you have to get close to it. And the closer you get to it, the more susceptible you are to them tinkering with you, and you almost become a little bit corrupted or use a little bit more aggressive means to subdue your prey, and they with those you begin tinkering with chaos to fight chaos, and it's just like this downward spiral that you can't really avoid. Similar to kind of the Inquisitors in 40K.
Yeah, it's really easy for GM to bring in Khorne. You know, if you get a tough foe and it's been a hard battle and someone takes out their aggression on it, you know, they try and hack the body to bits afterwards or something, you know, consider giving them some corruption points, but kind of having maybe even like a pool of corruption points in your own mind, like attributable to each power as well, you know, see which direction they're falling in if they're the kind of person that racks them up.
I'm glad you brought that up, because actually as soon as I finished saying that, I was thinking, God, I should talk about corruption points. How do you like to use corruption points in your games? How liberally do you hand them out? And it's maybe specifically related to Khorne in this adventure. How does the distribution of corruption points go hand? Because everybody does combat. It happens all the time, but you can't toss out corruption points every time you kill someone.
Yeah, I am the GM in our game, and I tend to give them out fairly irregularly, to be honest. But at the same time, I tend not to use the mechanic where you add an extra challenge dice in order to get rid of them very often, if ever at all. So generally, I kind of like to see them kind of slowly build up on my players to the point where they're starting to get a bit scared, really. Generally, I let players get rid of them through a hefty donation to one of the temples if they're in a large settlement. But I think if you're giving them out too liberally, unless you are fighting against some particularly disgusting kind of chaos creations, then you do just need to kind of be a little bit careful about how you deal with them. But I think generally you don't have to necessarily always have them with combat as well. If you maybe fail a fear test against or a terror test against a chaotic creature, or again if you act in outside of combat in a way that is befitting of one of the chaos powers as well, you know, that's a good opportunity to give them to a player. And it may be as well just to spook them a little bit that you wait a little bit to give them out. You don't just instantly throw out a corruption point across the table to a player. You kind of maybe subtly hand it to them a little bit later just to get them thinking about, you know, what's this doing here?
I like that. Where did this come from? What did I just do?
Yeah, the way I was handling it before they brought in the corruption points was if, like, I had a couple people who like to get really violent because of the nature of the world in the game, and I like to just make them roll not resiliency checks, discipline checks, and give them temporary insanities for doing stuff like that. Obviously appropriate ones, but that's how I was handling it before. I like your suggestions, though, for using the corruption to handle instances with Khorne, and, well, just the general the four powers in general.
So, Ian, what is your most what part of the new Omens of War expansion excites you the most, or what part of it really kind of gets you going?
To me, I'm actually looking forward to quite a few things I didn't do. I know quite a few of my players are fairly combat orientated, and I know they've been really looking forward to some of the new careers so they can take themselves up to the next level. We've been playing pretty much since the game came out, so we're probably most of the players are kind of just getting to the point of just gone into rank 4 in the last few weeks, so they're kind of...
Oh, wow, so you guys were itching for some high-level content then.
Yeah, so most of them are going into a third career at this point, so definitely looking to get some kind of intermediate or advanced careers under their belts for the combat characters, because the kind of wizard, he's obviously been sorted out for a little while. So, yeah, definitely looking forward to those, and I'm also definitely looking forward to sticking some severe wounds on the players as well, because I think they're going to be really fun.
So what you've been working with in what capacity do you get involved with Fantasy Flight?
So I'm now a freelancer for them, effectively they get in touch with me when they would like me to help contribute to an upcoming product, and they effectively tell me pretty much straight up how much involvement they would want from me, and put out the topics they're interested in me having a bash at writing.
Okay. So how long have you been doing that with them?
So I guess we first applied about this time last year.
And you said that's some of the other members of your gaming group also do some of the writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a couple of us that now are freelancing, which is, again, pretty cool. So we heard back probably, I think, in about June of 2010, and I started writing for the first time in late August 2010.
Nice.
And Lester, you had at one point contributed some stuff to their I'm not sure the right word for it, their roster or their pool or their
Just searched the website for possible job opportunities, and they're like constantly hiring freelance writers from what I understand, or at least interested in freelance writers. So I took a crack at it and sent them some stuff, and it was on and off with the communication, but it took I'd say about 3 months for them to really get back to me and give me, they have like a freelance writing questionnaire kind of, where they get you to write several different articles or whatever, you know, 500 word pieces. And then they gauge that from there. They got back to me quite quickly after that. And then they wanted me to write some more stuff. So I wrote another couple pieces, and most of it was just content that I'd wanted. I wrote that one story that I sent to you, and then I sent mm-hmm. that to them, and they told me that I'm in the database now. But it's a waiting game. Like Ian was saying, if you're getting into freelance writing, it's definitely a waiting game. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Ian, doing a little research myself, I found your profile on freelancer.com, and I noticed that you actually have got your BA from in history, actually, in Durham. And that's interesting. I want to know if that's something that really helps you, helps people take you more seriously, the fact that you have lots of experience with post-secondary.
Interesting. Do you know what? Actually, when I applied to do this, FFG didn't really take into account qualifications as such. I said I did the questionnaires and the like, and they got back to me and said, hey, you know, we'll stick you on our list. But obviously, as part of that, you know, they said that they were looking for high standards of writing and grammatical correctness, etc., and also, at the same time, a good knowledge of the Warhammer world. And I think as long as you can write well and you can write in a way that means they're not going to have to spend huge amounts of time proofreading your stuff because it's full of errors, and you know the Warhammer world, that's probably all you need. But at the same time, don't expect to be the next Bill Gates if you go into a career in freelancing.
It's more like pick up cash, right? It's more to kind of to support your RPGing. And I mean, if you're into the wargaming at all, it is quite an expensive hobby, but there's so many outlets for creativity within that. I find it fascinating. I wish I had more immediate access to Great Britain, because it's a lot bigger over there than it is here in Canada.
You actually have a Warhammer world out there, don't you? The mega battle bunker or whatever what's it called out there?
Warhammer it is world. Warhammer world, yeah. I'll tell you what, I've never
so envious. You've never been? Oh, I was going to hope to get a first-hand account of it.
Well, I'm just taking a shot in the dark, but I'm assuming you're from southern England, or at least you live in that general region.
Yeah, I live in London at the minute. So,
sweet.
Actually, it's not as well served as you may imagine for gaming shops, etc. I think, you know, rents around here are so expensive compared to the rest of the country that a lot of those shops probably struggle to get by, and it's actually a lot of them are all based around Nottingham, where Games Workshop's based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sweet. Okay, I want to ask you one more question myself. I was wondering, without like giving anything away? I mean, because I'm assuming that you might have a little bit of inside knowledge on what's going on in the processes with FFG right now. I'm just curious to know if there's anything that you would like to see the game FFG do to develop the game further in the future. Apart from things that are already on the schedule, like they're obviously doing Slaanesh, but I'm just curious to know as a, you know, one Warhammer fan to another.
Yeah, obviously, you know, I've signed an NDA with FFG, so there's going to be no specifics. From my own personal point of view, I think there's probably a lot of second edition players out there that would like to see Halflings come back at a point in time. Mm-hmm. And I know we've also got a player in my group who is a big merchant. He's kind of worked his way up to being relatively wealthy from nothing, and he would like to see more detailed rules on trading and perhaps commodities, different things you can buy. Personally, I'm not so sure that's the direction FFG are going in, but I probably would like to see maybe a supplement that did include slightly more detailed equipment lists, a few more kind of different types of arms and armor. The old world armory for second edition for me is a really kind of fantastic resource, just because it's got so much amazing weaponry in it, all kinds of stuff, pigeon bombs and all kinds of crazy imperial inventions that are just really cool to read about.
Yeah, it's got lots of cool stuff about currency in that too. I really like that. Actually, you should have your friend who's interested in the merchant stuff check out Liber Fanatica 8, because I do know I'm doing some proofreading for that and other work on that, and there's actually a trading and smuggling article that's being written into that for a whole bunch of different rules.
Ralph wrote that himself.
Oh, you know Ralph. There you go.
Yeah, fair enough. He plays with me.
It's a small world.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
Right on. We should, but Lester, you were also working on the Liber Fanatica 8. You were adding some content for the, for travel rules, right?
Well, kind of. It's kind of gone in a different direction. I'm writing that, and it's more than likely going to be an apocrypha. It probably won't go into Liber Fanatica 8. It doesn't really fit the theme at all. The theme is criminality and the, like the criminal empire and that kind of aspect of the world. And this is more of a broad-based thing, and I think it would be more well-served as kind of like a modular apocrypha on the side, because there's quite a bit of content. Like, we've been developing it for a while now, and, you know, taking a crack, practicing my writing skills for if FFG ever gets back to me on that.
Yeah, always great. I mean, absolutely anyone who's interested should just try and get writing as much as possible. I mean, I contributed to Liber Fanatica 7, I was unfortunately a bit too busy to put anything in 8. And as I said,
What did you do in 7?
The GM's Corner.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
Super. I'll have to try and find a way to incorporate my map into your travel rules and maybe some future trade rules.
Well, that's the plan as of right now. Like, I'm actually writing it around having your map be used as kind of the tool to judge distance and stuff like that. Because you have, I like the Google Maps version, how you've written it into the program. You can do
that. Yeah, that was actually, I think Sunitet did the coding for that.
Yeah, it's too bad that he's MIA now.
Mm-hmm, it is. But, okay, so maybe to wrap it up, Ian, we have one last very important question for you. Since you can't answer anything about what's referencing your non-disclosure agreement, Dan, one of our other members of the podcast, needs a new handle. And what's your take a crack at it? What he's currently called Dan Crimson Avenger Kerrigan, and he thinks he's a little too generic right now. So give us something exciting.
That's pretty long. Okay, I do listen to the show every week, but tell me one thing about Dan, and then we'll see what we can do.
When I used to work at Games Workshop, Dan was a regular customer, and I introduced him to the hobby. He, since that day, has been a very adamant follower of Games Workshop, both tabletop, fantasy, 40K, and this is his first role-playing game.
Okay, interesting.
And I think he even used to do World War II reenactments for the 101st Airborne and did some parachuting or something like that.
Wow, okay, that's pretty cool.
Like, get full up gear and everything.
Well, so. Maybe he should be, you know, maybe he needs his Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 101, but that's not very short either.
All right, we'll try and fold some other things. As you think of it, maybe shoot us another email later on when we air the show. We'll try and pull the roster together and think of something embarrassing for him, because he promised that he would abide by whatever we decided on.
Dan Drop Pod Carrick.
I can't let my favorite one out yet. I'll save it for the end of the show. Well, Ian, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. We look forward to seeing some more of your future content.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
What's your favorite one before we go? What is the piece of content that you're most looking forward to in the near future? That you're contributing to.
Ooh, there's nothing I'm contributing to that I can talk about at the minute.
But therefore, you are contributing to something.
I can't confirm or deny that.
Cool. I'm looking forward to seeing some more of your content. I'm really excited to go back and read now the stories that I know that you've contributed to in Omens of War. And hopefully we'll get to talk to you again soon on the show.
Okay, brilliant.
And we're back. And thanks again to Ian for taking the time out to speak with us. Our first interview, I think it went really well. Thanks, guys, for getting that done. And hope everybody enjoyed that as well. So
yeah, it was a lot of fun.
So for our next segment, we're going to dig into less of the mechanics and more of what else has been provided in Omens of War. And I was actually pretty surprised with the amount of, for lack of a better term, fluff has been included in this.
It's very concise. They managed to get a lot of content in these tight little books they produce.
Yeah, they kind of give an idea of, you know, they start off with kind of the highlights of battles throughout the years, going into the Skaven Wars, the Vampire Wars, the Great War Against Chaos, and
I was really pleased to see that they weren't just concentrating on battles of the Empire. And it was really just kind of worldwide Warhammer lore battles. That was a little unexpected. I was kind of assuming they would continue this kind of Empire, everything from the Reichland focus.
Well, but that is definitely, I mean, a big part of that. A big part of the Omens of War book is that war across the Empire. I mean, you've got a good 9 pages where it goes province by province in the Empire and gives basically kind of an example of a big battle that occurred there, which is kind of interesting because, you know, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition is a role-playing game. It's not a war game. Warhammer already has their own war game. So how do you run war in a role-playing game? And I think the way that they showed...
With a tracking token.
Well, and that is the one thing that isn't in here from a mechanics standpoint, is they don't have any mass combat rules, which, again, you know, knowing the way that
hadn't they kind of hinted that that was going to be part of this supplement and then kind of backed out of it?
That's what I understood.
I saw some people complaining on the forums about that, and I don't really miss it, but I... It is still a little curious.
Even if you go into the fantasy side of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, what is it like? You know, think about a tabletop battle with Warhammer Fantasy battles. You know, what's it like to be the third pikeman in the second row?
Exactly.
How much of an adventure is that? You know, it's it's march here, stay together. Don't die.
I think from a practical perspective, if you're going to include a mass battle in one of your games, in all likelihood, the players, your PCs, are going to be part of a scouting party or something where you hold the right hand flank with your small contingent of people. I mean, those are the kind of things that you're never going to be part of a major battle and be able to portray it successfully to the level of detail that I think a lot of people were hoping to see.
Well, I like the way that Ian talked about it and how he says his gaming group actually plays the battle game. Then they incorporate the three different, like they incorporate Mordheim, the role playing and also the battles game to create this epic campaign story. So if you really want to get into that, and if you're really interested in doing in acting big battles from Warhammer, you're better off to just get into the battles game itself, because like Paul was saying, it would be very boring to be, you know, Joe Blow in the archery rank while the battle went on all around you.
And if you think Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay is expensive, try going out there and buying some lead. So
yeah. Pewter.
It's all plastic now, though. I mean, they're going pretty much all plastic kits.
I still call it lead, so.
It's pretty expensive, though.
So then it digs into, and we're still in the Omens of War. We haven't even touched the Liber Carnagia yet, where it actually goes into, well, how do other, and again, what you were talking about, Jesse, how do other races or other, styles of battle are out there. So it talks about ogres, it talks about elves, it talks about chivalry and what happens in Nordland and what happens with the wood elves and things like that as well. So it's kind of a nice, even down to Lustria, and mentions the old ones and the lizardmen. So that's pretty cool. It really gives you kind of that overview. And then it digs into the knightly orders, the six orders that we talked about.
You know, before we get into the knightly orders, I want to touch real quick. This is actually the first book, I think, in third edition where it actually gives you a little bit of a sampling of the whole Warhammer world, not just Empire focus.
Or even specifically Reichland.
Right. I mean, this has information on Skaven, ogres, lizard men. None of that stuff has been present in any book prior to this. Now, granted, you're not getting a whole cultural overview, but the first half of this book might be the best summary to give a new player a broad view of Warhammer to date. You know, of the third edition content. I'm sorry?
Yeah. A possible future look, maybe? Maybe they're like, giving us little hints of what's to come, you know?
Well, certainly as they continue, they're going to be hitting up on each of the focus races of the game. But, I'm liking that they're starting to broaden out of just the Reichland Empire area and start mentioning kind of the greater Warhammer world.
Yeah. Well, I was bummed that I missed the Skaven episode, that I couldn't make that, because they are absolutely my favorite.
We timed that specifically so you wouldn't be able to attend.
No, the Montreal Canadiens timed losing.
No, we dealt with them and made sure that they would lose and go into overtime just so that you wouldn't be able to record.
Makes sense. Well,
we took that out of the budget.
It was more of a respect thing, because it was so loud here. There was a bunch of drunk frat boys yelling and screaming and playing Kinect because, you know, the team lost, so they felt they needed to get really drunk.
Fraternities are so cool.
Yeah, speaking of fraternities, what about these knightly orders?
Oh, thank you for rolling it back in. So
you're good with segues tonight.
So there's
good with segues all the time, man.
So there's the breakdown of, now this does come back into mostly the Empire. I mean, it is specifically the Knights of the Empire, but it gives you a good idea on what is it to be a knight, and specific style of knight or specific order of knight as well. Even throws in some quick jousting rules.
Yeah, I was just about to say that.
That's awesome.
So it is a great overview. And then we're up to Chapter 5, where it actually breaks down military organizations. So when the Empire goes to war, what does that actually look like? And it's even got a cool breakdown, a cool order of battle of two different armies that are there, the Battle of Iceclaw Falls and the Grand Army of Baron von Rushival. So it actually breaks it down and says, here's your army general. And it shows a little icon of him, and then here's the captain, and then here's the halberdier regiment.
Big artillery train.
Yeah, 123 men in the halberdier regiment, and then detachments of 38 crossbowmen and 25 swordsmen, spearmen regiments, two spearmen regiments, huntsman regiment, a warrior priest of Sigmar, a knights, mortars, flagellants, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of cool to see it all broken down like that.
Sounds a lot like the battle games, like army.
Oh, I mean, yeah, it almost is. I mean, this is about the size. This is a little bigger than the average army you'd field, but it's it's still pretty, pretty neat to see it drawn out like this. Kind of see where your one little guy fits into the grand scheme.
So that's the kind of good side of things. Now the bad side of things, the Liber Carnaggio, because
before we jump into Liber Carnaggio, there's one bit I wanted to throw out there. Of course, the remainder of the book talks about the expanded rules like mounted combat and whatnot, but they do provide a very quick kind of one pager adventure for a carriage chase. I think it's on page 45. So I know a lot of people really enjoy those little one-pagers or things you can insert into an adventure very easily or do as an intro. And if you really want to play around with the new mounted rules, here's a chance to do it.
Yeah, those specific episodes that they have, the episode templates, those are all over the GM's guide and the GM's toolkit. So those are some really good modules for you as a GM to kind of have in your back pocket, because you can string a couple of those together to make your own adventure, or if you've got kind of downtime in between, you know, the parts of a written adventure that you're running, throw in an episode, you know, pull that out and slap one of those in. Definitely cool stuff.
The Daily Empire is running a contest, or at least a compilation right now, trying to gather as many, you know, one pager, even though these templates are templates, they're also, you know, if you just play them on their own, are a good one pager, and they're doing a promotion on that right now, and they've got quite a few good ones up there.
Cool. So let's get to the star of the show for Omens of War, and that's Khorne. So this is the Book of Khorne, just as the magic one was Tzeentch and the faith one was Nurgle. This one's all about Khorne. So you get that breakdown of not only who Khorne is and what he does, but also his minions, his demons, and his servants.
Now, Lester, I know you'd like Khorne. What's your take on him?
He is awesome. He's pretty much like you said. I can't remember what episode it was, but you said that he's kind of like the staple beginning Chaos God. Most people can relate to him the easiest because, mm-hmm. I mean, most people who start out playing role-playing games or are new to it tend to want to just hack things to pieces. And that's kind of where Khorne comes into play, because the more violence that you are exposed to, the more likely he will like caress your mind with his bloody tendrils, and then you eventually can go crazy. And his worshippers, that's all they do. They are completely combat driven.
So to bring it in, I mean, Khorne is the blood god. God of combat, the god of rage, the god of hate. I mean, he is, any time any kind of aggressive act is involved, on some level, Khorne could be attributed.
Yeah,
you know, his some of the famous sayings are blood for the blood god, skulls for the skull throne.
Yeah.
You know, Khorne's got this huge bastion and this giant throne on top of this just mountain of skulls.
Yeah. Well, Khorne is the oldest of the four gods, or so it is believed, and he also lives in the largest realm. And
arguably
he's
because all the realms are kind of fed by how much on the mortal world their traits are portrayed. So combat is so rampant in the old world and the world in general that Khorne is just constantly fed just through the strife of the world.
Precisely. And his other brothers kind of feel he's a little bit of a dolt. He's not overly clever, because everything that he solves with a weapon. So like a sneaky murderer who creeps around and murders people is most likely not going to be a Khorne worshiper, because they are proud of what they do. They would like run through the streets and slaughter people out in the open, or go to war, as opposed to stab someone in the back, you know?
Khorne is never subtle.
And the other interesting thing about Khorne is that he does not care how something dies, whether you meant to do it, whether it was an accident, whether you murdered somebody. None of that matters to him. He's just happy when something dies.
As long as it was bloody.
Exactly. And if you accidentally killed something, you could still be, you know, getting his gaze.
Yeah.
It's just the act of killing and the act of bloodshed is what excites him.
Yeah, it's him and Slaanesh that are the opposites, right? Because I believe Tzeentch and Nurgle are opposites.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Change versus decay, and then pain versus pleasure, or rage versus, what's the word I'm looking for? Leisure.
Yes.
So.
So the other interesting thing, Khorne is a lot of the Northmen tribes, which I think even the adventure focuses on in the Liber Carnagia, is the Northmen tribes tend to be like raiding Norsemen, and they're very aggressive, and they tend to draw the gaze of Khorne probably more than many of the other Chaos gods. So I think it's a little very appropriate that the Marauders of the North tend to be followers of Khorne more often than not.
They worship Khorne, but they worship him in many different guises. Like, he has many different names to many different tribes, sort of thing.
Good. Anything else we want to talk about? I mean, he's kind of the straightforward guy.
You know, we did get some new mutations with Khorne and the Khorne mm-hmm. gifts when he does choose a follower that he is particularly interested in. The gifts of Khorne tend to be very physically and combat oriented. They could be like tougher skin, bigger muscles, things like weapon hands, spikes. You know, some of this the gnarly physical combat stuff. And Khorne is very, very prone to frenzied combat. You'll notice in your box set, you get another like 5 frenzy cards into your deck of already like 20.
Oh, and for all the game masters out there, if you're ever running followers of Khorne, they will never run from battle. They will always fight to the death.
Absolutely.
So I'm looking here at the summary of the demonic and mortal servants of Khorne, and I notice that on the stance, they're all reckless. There's no conservative Khorne followers.
Not one.
so you say that all those followers probably follow this podcast on Twitter?
Ah, there you go. Now you might be stretching for that segue there.
So let's cover the demons real quick. So we've paid special attention in the other two gods to kind of cover what there is. And let's maybe go from the smallest to the largest. Everybody should be familiar with the Fleshhound of Khorne, which comes in your core set. That thing's like an overgrown dog bat thing.
You know, until we started this podcast, I never caught the whole corn dog thing.
Really? You have to go all the way back to episode 1 to get that joke?
It's always fleshhounds in my mind, or demons of Khorne. I never clicked with me that, oh, here comes the corn dog.
Oh, wow. That's like I get it, 4.5 months later.
So the fleshhound is kind of the beast. Then the lesser demons are the bloodletters, right?
Right. Those are kind of your, if you recall, every chaos god kind of has your humanoid-esque counterpart. We have the plague bearers for Nurgle. So the Khorne has the bloodletters, and they are fiendishly nasty. But they also often can ride into combat on what's called a juggernaut of Khorne, which is this giant, almost like bull-looking armored contraption. And they don't really ever hint as to what's inside outside of it being a demon, but is it mechanical? Is it fleshy? It's kind of hard to say. But then as you creep up into a little bit bigger stuff, you've got an awesome-looking demon prince. And then, of course, probably the most famous greater demon of all, which is the Bloodthirster of Khorne, who is that really huge, bat-winged, wolf-headed, humanoid, axe-wielding, crazy monster of death.
And when you think of the demons of Khorne, they are your stereotypical demons. They are red, black, gold, blood dripping, flames, all that kind of, that's really kind of the themes and the styles of Khorne as well.
I believe his colors are red, bronze, and black,
Yep.
And anybody who wants to see pictures of these things, you can just go to Games Workshop's website, and you can see pictures of all the models. There's some, I think that Khorne's got some really fantastic models in the game. The demons are awesome. Really good villains.
So that kind of covers Khorne. I think the last thing we want to talk about with Omens of War, and I feel a little bad for doing it, but we're kind of going in order, is unfortunately in my mind, the most disappointing part of the set, which is the adventure that was included, Crimson Rain.
So I haven't finished reading it. I'm about halfway through it. So I'm capable of not giving out too many spoilers.
And I'm not going to give out spoilers either. I mean, I've read through the whole thing and I've looked at it and I've got two big issues with the adventure.
Let's maybe cover what's the premise of the adventure so people can kind of get the idea.
The premise of the adventure is a marauder raid on a northern town. So a northern town in the empire. Right. Yes, exactly. So that raid occurs while the PCs are within the town. And then what happens after that, what occurs during it, all of those sorts of things is kind of where the adventure falls. And that's really my first issue with the adventure is that there isn't a lot of detail to it. And they even kind of cop to it in the introduction to it. It's more of an outline of an adventure than an actual adventure.
I think the focus of the adventure, unlike some of the previous ones to date where you have a series of very specific things that happen in a certain order, this one, the focus of the adventure or the plot was to understand how characters would how their actions would influence the attention of Korn throughout throughout the adventure. So what it incorporates is this tracking system of how likely your characters are to be susceptible to, you know, Korn's influences. I'll probably leave it there. But that was very intriguing to me, and actually I thought that was it sounded very exciting. Now in actual practice and play, I haven't tried it yet, but it seemed like a really neat concept to explore.
I like the idea of the concept, Jesse, and that is definitely the theme of the adventure is, you know, how do you fight for great justice but not fall to the dark side, to be cliche. But the problem is that they already have that built into the system. It's called corruption. The corrupting influence of chaos is already accounted for in the system. And the idea that they have to go down this different track and take this different mechanic and system and, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. I'm not going to dig into it because it's all about spoilers. It just threw me off. I mean, the whole concept that you're talking about, the potential falling of significant characters, PCs, NPCs to chaos, and corruption is never mentioned once in the entire adventure.
I did notice that. That irked me a little bit.
Big misstep.
I in my mind was just automatically substituting their tracking system for like, okay, well, at what intervals do I hand out corruption?
Yeah.
Instead, yeah. You know. But it looked like a fun adventure, and just as a maybe to kind of sum it up and to give one last bonus for everybody out there, for anybody who does use the big Warhammer map, I did include all of Norska and revamped the new Emskrank region. So the new map is completely updated to account for all the content that was released in this supplement.
And again, my problems with the adventure doesn't mean that you shouldn't get this, supplement. I mean, especially if you have any kind of a military or martial focus to it, or, you know, if the horses, that's a great mechanic that's being added, the knightly orders, the fighting styles, the enhancement cards, you know, that's all very cool stuff. So, you know, the adventure, it is what it is. I'm definitely disappointed with it, but, you know, that's just one small part of the whole package.
You could probably flesh it out more. Like, I haven't read it yet, but you could
absolutely
change it around a little bit. It probably acts, from what I'm understanding from how you guys are portraying it, it's more like those one-shots that you were talking about earlier where it's pretty open-ended, easy to manipulate yourself.
Yeah. There definitely is parts of that in there, and there is a full structure, you know, a beginning, a middle, an end to it, and things like that. But it just seemed a little, in my mind, just a little slapdash. But I don't want to dwell on that. I mean, let's. Anything else? Anything that we missed in terms of talking about Omens of War? I mean, I'm very pleased with it.
Let's do a last roundtable, and you know, would we recommend it, Lester?
Well, I'm gonna go.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Well, I'm going to purchase it on Thursday. I'm going to give it two thumbs and two toes that look eerily similar to thumbs up. So that would be four thumbs
in total. I think that's a mutation. So
I'm just glad he didn't say five thumbs. That's slanish though, right? Sorry.
Yeah, we'll wait. We'll wait for the five thumbs.
Paul, would you recommend it?
From my perspective, I think it's
the product as a whole.
I think exactly the same as Signs of Faith and Winds of Magic. If your characters and campaign has a focus to it, then it's absolutely worth it. Just like if your characters or campaign has a focus on magic, you absolutely want Winds of Magic. Or if you're talking about faith, you absolutely want Signs of Faith. If you're talking about military combat type focus, things like that, absolutely want Omens of War.
So I think this product still falls into one of your first three expansion content blocks. You know, like you said, the Signs of Faith, Winds of Magic, and the Omens of War are going to be the three ones that I would suggest hitting before you move into things like the Gathering Storm, the Edge of Night, those kind of content.
Sounds good. All right, I think that wraps it up for Omens of War. So with this super long episode, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll run through real quick a couple questions.
As always, you can submit your questions to recklessdice@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @recklessdice. Wilmax asks us on the web, have you noticed the very limited difference between the two black dice from an active defense card with the right skill trained and one challenge dice from an improved active defense card?
Basically, what I understand him to be saying here is if you have, so let's say in parry. So if you have, what is the skill trained for parry? I don't have my cards in front of me right now.
The skill trained?
Yeah, what is the skill that they want you to have trained? Weapon skill, like, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, I think so. That makes sense.
So if you have, everybody gets parry as long as you meet the requirements. If you have weapon skill trained, you add two black dice to any incoming attack against you if you use your parry card. If you take the improved parry card, it replaces parry, and it basically replaces that with just a purple dice. So you don't actually get that special bonus. You don't get the additional black dice according to the card. However,
so which one is more effective then? Is it the two black dice statistically better than a purple?
No. The purple is like 1% better than the black dice or something like that using the tool that you showed me, the percentile calculator, the dice calculator. But the thing that needs to be taken into account here is that the improved cards, the improved active defenses actually have a special ability. So if you are ever missed by the incoming attack, you get to do something additional. So with a parry, you get to remove a recharge token from any of your currently recharging melee action cards.
Okay.
So you get that little bit of a stat bonus or that little bit of a probability bonus. The other thing, also take into account that misfortune dice don't have chaos stars on them, whereas the challenge dice do. So, you know, there's bad effects that can happen to the attacking person if you roll those chaos stars, even if they successfully hit you.
And the challenge,
And then above and beyond that, like you just said, Lester, there's that extra effect that happens if they do miss.
And let's also not forget the challenge dice has the opportunity to roll two cross swords on a single die face.
Exactly.
And that's where the additional negation of success comes in from a probability standpoint. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Furlong Doug emails, I'd like to hear you spend some time discussing random versus non-random generated characters. I've now gone 100% random in race and career. I personally think it's the way to go. Folks tend to focus on the cool stuff and forget the best protagonists come from humble beginning. Even the great Felix was a scholar before choosing the destiny of adventure. Random careers force someone to really breathe some life into a character and helps to shed the class thinking.
Absolutely. Whenever you let people choose their character, choose their career, they're going to go for the bounty hunters, they're going to go for the wizards, they're going to go for, you know, they're going to go for the, what's considered the power classes. Mm. I love the idea, not random race so much, because I don't, that's a little bit too random for me, and I, you know, give the players some choice to choose the race, but the draw three, keep one that's written in, that's in the rules is written. I love that idea, and I highly encourage people to do that.
I think the only reason that the other one has any merit at all is when you're dealing with new players. Because if you want to get new players interested in the game, you want to give them options. And especially new role players who don't have any real experience, I think they will have an easier time role playing a career that they get to choose, as opposed to just trying to role play a career that maybe they have no idea. Like somebody draws boatman and they have no idea how to play a boatman.
I would agree with you, but at the same time, thinking back to some of my most memorable role-playing moments, not even specific to Warhammer, it was the times when I was forced to play a pre-gen character or something like that where I didn't have that control at the beginning, like when it was a new system. Those were the times that the stories and the interactions were so much more memorable. And I think it, on some level, it had to do with the fact that I was forced to play something I wasn't that familiar with and had to actually role play it.
But you were familiar with role playing though.
Oh, sure, familiar with role playing.
That's what I'm saying. People brand new to role playing.
And I think, Lester, at that point, I mean, if you're really looking at doing the hand holding, then you're in the realm of pre-gens at that point.
Yeah, actually making characters?
Yep.
Well, I like to let them make characters if they're brand new to role playing, but I'm with Furlong Doug. I do agree that the random generation, for people who know role playing, that's the way to go easily.
Yep.
So Stephen H. Zick emails, it seems to me that opposed tests could have some could cause some confusion. Here's an example from the forums. Two guys grappling, both have strength of 2. Very difficult opposed test, 2 purple versus 2 blue. Two guys grappling, both have strength 5. A very easy 2 purple versus 5 blue. Also, we were playing a day late and a shilling short, and after we defended the coach, one of our party tried to intimidate the merchant into paying us to lug his stuff back to town. The character had a strength 4, and I think the merchant had an opposing stat of 4. But the merchant also had special things just for negotiating. How would this test be done? So let's maybe split that into two pieces there. First things first, let's cover real quickly how do opposed checks work.
Yeah, you're making me go to the book, man. I should have looked this up ahead of time. We just got a nice comment from folks saying how much we prepared for these questions and these podcasts.
Well, obviously, we'll be editing the searching part out.
So you know, if we're looking at opposed checks, so basically it's a characteristic against a different characteristic. So, the concept is, you know, in a test of strength, it's strength versus strength, as it's mentioned. The opposed check difficulty is defined as if it's less than half of the characteristics. So if you have a strength 4 against strength 1, then it's 0 challenge dice. If it's more than half but less, it's 1. If it's equal, it's 2. If it's greater, it's 3 challenge dice. If it's twice as great, it's 4 challenge dice. So what Steven's getting to there is that, you know, if your strength of 5, being opposed by a strength of 5, then you're rolling 5, you have an average difficulty check. Versus a strength of 2 against a strength of 2 is still an average difficulty check. I get what he's getting at.
What he's getting at is that the amount of blue dice you're rolling increases, but the amount of purple dice you're rolling don't increase.
But again, you've got a strength of 5, right? If you take a look at the guy with a strength of 5 versus the strength of 2.
No, it wasn't 5 versus 2. It was 2 versus 2 and 5 versus 5.
Right, but take a look. Put yourself in the role playing. Get away from the numbers, right? You've got the big badass guy, mm-hmm. right? He's got an average test to accomplish something, right? He's going to be pretty successful at that because he's a big badass guy. But if he goes up against a wimpy guy, that's not just an average test. That's a simple test. Right? Because if it's the 5 versus 2, you're not talking about a challenge of 2 dice, you're talking about a challenge of 0 dice. So.
I think the part you're missing, and maybe he didn't explain it well, is that the strength of 5, like let's say you and I are grappling, we both have strength 5. I'm the attacker. I'm gonna roll, and because our strengths are equal, That's going to be an average check of 2 purple dice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to roll 2 purple dice plus a number of blue dice equal to my strength, 5. So I'm going to roll 2 purple and 5 blue dice for that roll.
Yeah, I think
my statistical chance of succeeding at that roll is vastly superior than the alternate example of where we each have strength 2, where I would be rolling 2 purple dice and 2 blue dice. We both have the same strength. We both have the same opportunity to defend or combat each other, but the disparity of your chance of success, the higher your stats are, even if your opponent has that same high stat, is a little, there's some connection there that seems to get lost as the numbers raise.
Like, why is it easier for a strength 5 guy to grapple another strength 5 guy than it is for a strength 2 guy to grapple a strength 2 guy?
And it's not only a little bit easier, it's lots easier.
Oh yeah, it's significantly easier, but like that, I think that's what he's getting at.
It is exactly what he's getting at. I don't know what to say. I agree with him. I think it's weird.
I don't have an answer for that.
The only other thing that I'm looking at here is that there's the straight up regular, challenge levels. You know, you set a difficulty for a task and you just define 0 through 4 challenge dice for it. There's the opposed checks that we've been talking about here. And then there's the competitive checks. And the competitive checks are when, and they specifically talk about things like, an arm wrestling competition, where it isn't, you know, my actions upon the other person.
Mm-hmm.
They're both acting on each other equally. So it's who gets to a certain number of successes first.
Okay.
So you would each roll that, like, if we're both a 5 and 5 arm wrestling, I'd roll 2 purple and my 5 blue, and you'd do the same, and we'd compare success pools.
Right, and the first one to 5 successes wins, or the first one, you know, the one with more successes wins.
That makes much more sense to me.
That makes a lot more sense to me. That's probably how I'll run it from now on, because I was just doing the straight opposed check, and I was finding it to be a little strange myself.
Yeah, so that's actually page 52 in the player's guide under competitive checks. I don't know if it's in the base book, the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplayer, or not, but that's what I've got in front of me.
So let's quickly answer the last part of his question, where he outlines a intimidation or check where the character had a strength of 4 and the merchant had an opposing stat of 4, but the merchant had some special training in negotiating. How do we handle this? I think it's pretty straightforward. We're going to do just like we said before. You're going to roll your 4 blue dice along with 2 purple, and you'll probably add some misfortune dice, kind of the opposite version of what the merchant might be doing if he was making the negotiating, where he would be adding fortune dice. You'll add 1 or 2 misfortune dice to the roll.
Yep, and don't forget NPCs get the aggression, cunning, and expertise as well. So
yeah,
you know, you can justify throwing in some misfortune or dice for that.
That comes in a lot of handy for sure.
Yep, cool. So I think that's going to wrap it up. Thanks, everyone. I know this is a super large episode, but I think we had a lot of good information and good stuff for you. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Please give us comments on our site, recklessdice.com or recklessdice.rorschach.net. Send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at recklessdice. And we've also got the Reckless Dice Facebook page. So we're all up in this social media stuff.
So I'd like to, over the next couple of days, I think we're going to try and get Dan's handle poll up on the Facebook page. So do us a favor and go check out the page, like us there, and go ahead and participate in that poll, and we'll announce the new name in 2 weeks.
Excellent. And please do, you know, give us a review on iTunes or throw some stars there as well. We appreciate that too. And thanks everybody for the listening. We're loving the feedback. We're loving the folks that are out there and the hundreds of downloads that are occurring for each episode. It's really keeping us jazzed and keeping us going. So hopefully we're bringing good information to you, and you guys are finding it entertaining and educational. So thanks again, and everybody have a good night.
Have a good one, guys.
Thanks for listening.